Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we know the Olympics as an expensive, entertaining, and kind of fantastical combination of art and athletics, but it hasn't always been that way. Our next guest, David Goldblatt, sports writer and author now of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, is here to tell us about some of the many ways that the Olympic Games have changed over the years. David Goldblatt, welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And let's start with 1896, which you write is the year of the first modern Olympic Games and the Lumiere brothers' tour of their revolutionary cinematograph, the machine that allowed them for the first time to show a projected moving picture to an audience. First of all, what do you mean by modern Olympic Games when you refer to 1896?
Well, the Olympic Games originally are a phenomena of ancient Greece and ancient Rome, starting sometime in the 9th century BC and carrying on towards of the 4th century BCE. And then they disappeared for all sorts of complex reasons, but mainly for the banning by the Roman, newly Christianized Roman Empire, of pagan practices, of which, of course, the Olympic Games were, because they were a religious as well as an athletic festival. And they disappeared from memory for the next 1,400 years. And so when de Coubertin came to the Olympics in the 19th century, they were always imagined as a revival in some sense, or a reinvention of those ancient games.
And how did the cinematograph change the games?
Well, in 1896, it didn't change it much, but one day it would, because when the Olympics began, or the modern Olympics began, I mean, there was barely any reporting. There was one person from the New York Times, somebody almost by accident from the Times of London, and certainly no electronic or mass media of any other kind. And what makes the Olympics over the last century is the fact that so many people want to read about it, watch it, and follow it, so that, you know, we have now literally half the world will tune into at least some of it. And cinema became absolutely vital to that process in the 1920s and the 1930s, before television became the main medium of communication. The cinema reels that would have been showed, you know, before the main feature were vital. And of course, ultimately, Leni Riefenstahl's movie made of the 1936 Berlin Games decried for its anti-Semitism and its obvious sort of political sympathies for the Nazi regime, was also the most extraordinary filmic project which transformed the way in which we look, and indeed we remember the 36 games, because, you know, who knows who did it, what did it look like? We know because we remember Riefenstahl. So films, and then the mass media more generally, have been absolutely central to the development of the Olympic Games.
You know, reading some of that section of the book and just remembering that the 1936 Olympics were in Berlin, obviously such a heavy time to have them there. The Nazis were already in charge. I realize it wasn't the Holocaust yet, and people didn't know everything that the Hitler regime would become. But 1936, that means that somebody, International Olympic Committee of some kind, decided with Hitler in charge that Germany was going to get the games?
Not quite. The Germans actually were awarded the games in 1931 in a postal vote against Barcelona. And at that point, though Hitler was clearly, one should have been worried, he certainly wasn't Chancellor. We're still in the Weimar Republic. And indeed, when the Nazis took power in 1933, the organisers of the Berlin Games and the International Olympic Committee were convinced that they would refuse to hold the games, because Nazi propaganda up until this point had made out that the Olympics were dangerously internationalist, almost certainly a Jewish conspiracy, and not something for any self-regarding Nazi to take part in. And then they go to the meeting, Theodor Liewald and Karl Diem, who are the organisers of the Games, and Hitler springs a surprise on them. And in discussion with Goebbels, he's come round to the idea that here is the most fantastic opportunity to project the new Germany onto the world. And indeed, they come to embrace, albeit with all sorts of caveats, the staging of the Games.
Listeners, any questions for David Goldblatt? sports writer and author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics, 212-433, WNYC, 433-9692. I want to go back one Olympics before that, 1932, in which L.A. hosted, and you describe it as really a turning point year because of the way they treated it like a Hollywood movie?
Absolutely. I mean, people think about Berlin 1936 as the moment when the Olympics become a global mediated spectacular. And indeed, you know, in many ways they do. But it's worth remembering that the guys organizing Berlin 36 are in Los Angeles in 1932, and they are taking notes, photographs, diagrams. It's laying out the model. I mean, for example, when the first thing that Los Angeles's Olympic Committee does once it's formed and it's got the Games, it sets up a press department. Nobody's had a press department before. No one's made facilities for journalists easy. And above all, no one's thought that it's really important to make sure that every event is packed in the stands. And so LA sets up, you know, the simple expediency of a ticket line with a telephone. So at that level, it's completely different. And of course, it brings some of the kind of the celebrity, the glamour, the mechanisms used by Hollywood and its star system is shared with the Olympic Games, bringing it together with the most sort of powerful force in popular culture in a way that's never happened before. So, you know, Louis B. Mayer from MGM is on the organizing committee. Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Jr., you know, are appearing on the radio with the Marx Brothers and Bela Lugosi and Laurel and Hardy saying, come to Hollywood, come to the Olympic Games. This kind of stardust has never been available, and Hollywood changes that Los Angeles changes the relationship between popular culture, celebrity, and sport in a way that no one's done before.
Was there also any attempt to project a certain image to the world of the United States? Like you describe, obviously, for Germany in 36, and that we these days think of, I think, with respect to the China Olympics and other countries that have it today?
Absolutely, but it wasn't an American story that was being projected. It was very much a Southern Californian one. William Garland, who was the man, the sort of force behind the Games, you know, was twice president of the National Association of Realtors. And, you know, the Los Angeles Games were very much about telling the world about the Southern Californian paradise, you know, Athens on the Pacific, this new, the Southland, as it was often referred to at the time, where, you know, new trends in styles, in fashions, in lifestyles, in outdoor healthy sports all came together, you know, and it was very much a case of selling Los Angeles and the Californian lifestyle to the world rather than a specifically American one.
Tom in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with David Goldblatt. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how's it going? I'm a huge fan of David Goldblatt. I love your book, The Falls Round.
Thank you.
But I have a question about that art and architecture medals in the Olympics. They used to give out medals for visual art and architecture, but they discontinued them. I don't know if you discuss that in your book, but that's an interesting kind of failure of aesthetics in the Olympic realm.
It's a really interesting story, and one I have some sympathy with, because de Coubertin, while I disagree with him in many ways, took the position that sport should be considered an integral part of culture, the equivalent, you know, equivalent to the arts, and that, you know, they should be fused together at the Olympic Games. The problem always was with arts competitions is gold medals, silver medals, bronze medals. In 1912, when this was first proposed to the Swedes who were staging the Games, the Swedish artistic community were consulted, and they all came back and said, this is absurd. You know, we're not going to get involved in this kind of competitiveness. And then the Baron went away and actually staged the first art competition from his own home, in effect, and awarded himself under a pseudonym the prize for poetry for a piece called Ode to Sport. So not a very august beginning. After that, they run for the next sort of 40 years. I think 1952 in Helsinki is the last, after which they become what we now know as the Cultural Olympiad, which is the sort of festivals and so on running alongside. And it was a very mixed bag, I've got to tell you, Tom. On the one hand, you know, you get something like Jack Butler Yeats, W.B. Yeats's younger brother and a great painter who wins the gold medal for a swimming picture, Swimming in the Liffey in 1924. But sometimes the contributions are so bad that the IOC itself felt that it couldn't actually give medals because the quality of what was coming in was so poor. So I think it's great to have art and culture at the Olympics. I'd like to actually see a lot more and a lot more interesting and alternative and diverse stuff. Competitions and gold medals, I think we should let them probably rest in peace.
Most of us non-Olympic athletes don't really know what kind of scene the typical Olympic village is like, though we do hear rumors. And that's another thing you write about in the book. What is it and how has that changed over the years?
Well, the Olympic village, you know, there's obviously an accommodation issue when you invite a lot of people from around the world to come and stay. But actually, the first village only begins in 1932, and this is, again, one of Los Angeles' fantastic innovations. In what is now the Baldwin Hills, they create a kind of pop-up, instant Californian suburb with these sort of delightful little bungalows and Navajo rugs and kind of Californian design. And actually, the Olympic Village, as well as functioning as a way of bringing athletes together and making accommodation reasonably cheap, the key thing with the village at LA is that here was somewhere for the press to go. Here was somewhere to construct a tableau against which to construct Olympic stories. And that's really how the Olympic village begins. And then LA being LA, of course, they sell off all the bungalows and the whole thing disappears. It only becomes the sort of giant sort of housing project that we now see really in the 1960s and 1970s. I mean, Mexico City builds an Olympic village of sort of 6,000 or 7,000 flats, and it becomes something altogether different. The other thing that's interesting with the Olympic village, particularly given the rumours you allude to, Brian, which I suspect is the sexual excitement and behaviour of all those young folks together in one place, is that it was only in 1964 that you got a mixed Olympic village. As late as 1960, women are being separated and put in their own Olympic village. And indeed in Rome, this created such a high degree of sexual tension in the city that you had throughout the games voyeurs with binoculars queuing up on a raised freeway to stare into the women athletes' rooms. And in fact, reports from the time suggest that women were putting up newspaper over their windows to block these guys out.
Wow. Sergey in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sergey.
Good morning. I've noticed that in recent years, there have actually been cities that have been turning down an offer to host the Olympics because of the high cost of building the venues and the disruption to daily life. And it seems that recently it's become totalitarian countries that are willing to foot the cost of the games. So how will the refusal of some cities impact the future of the games?
Well, one hopes, you know, that it will get the International Olympic Committee to think much harder about what kind of games it wants to stage and what the nature of the bidding process is. And to be fair to Thomas Bach, the president of the IOC, he reacted to precisely the problem you outline, where we get to the 2022 Winter Olympics and the choices between Almaty, capital of Kazakhstan, and Beijing in China, which is 180 kilometers from the nearest mountains. And that's clearly, you know, that's a problem. And as you rightly say, cities like Boston, Oslo, Hamburg, Stockholm have all been dropping out because the public, given the slightest chance to express their opinion, rightly says no. So there is a real problem here. And it's not just, you know, will it just be dictatorships? I mean, I suspect other countries may continue to. The problem is the model. How can we devise a model that is less destructive, that is more socially equitable, that leaves a real legacy? There's the problem. I don't think they've got anywhere close to sorting that out. And I think the caller's right to say if they don't, then the nature of the project is imperiled.
That's fascinating. We've just got about a minute left, and we've avoided all the contemporary hand-wringing about the Rio Olympics to focus on the content of your book, which is a history. But what will you be watching for in Rio of kind of broad historical importance? You know, people talk about how this is going to be such a disaster. We forget it was just a few years ago when we used to compare ourselves unfavorably to the so-called BRIC countries that have these growing economies, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And now Brazil is looked at as such a wreck. But what are you going to be watching for?
Well, I'm certainly going to be watching for Usain Bolt. I think, like everybody else, he's been the most extraordinary Olympic athlete of contemporary times. He's back for a third attempt. I mean, it's a spellbinding prospect, and I will be packing most of my cynicism away at that point. I think the other joy of the Olympics is to be a sports tourist. I certainly live in a country that's completely monomaniacal about football and everything else, or soccer. Nothing else really gets a look in. And so it's the extraordinary, unheard of sport, the extraordinary, unheard of athlete that I'll be looking out for. And at the moment, I can't say.
I love that unjaded answer. David Goldblatt, author of The Games, A Global History of the Olympics. And yes, it is okay to watch the games and enjoy the sport. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.